Welcome to Parcheesi Derivative, the show about data, data science, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. My name is Chris, and I'm hosting here today with Vidya.
Yes, you are. Vidya is the best host, co-host.
How have you been doing, Vid?
I've been pretty good. I've been trying to make some progress on my research on this whole education thing and the future of education. And it's been a lot of reading, like I said last week. So it's just been really cool. I've been meeting a lot of professors and teachers who are kind of getting overwhelmed with or tired of the way that their system is and trying to understand, like, from their perspective, what could be more useful as far as like them feeling like they're giving their students a, you know, an advantage when they go back into the job market. And it's interesting because there's, you know, I think clearly a trend in the from the teaching side to for them to be more connected with the practical doing mm-hmm. side so that they can bridge that gap for them. Whereas I remember when I was in school, a lot of my professors were definitely on the research front as far as computer science goes, and not too many were in the application side of things. And I guess, you know, at that time, getting a computer science degree was like kind of a standard. You know, there's a standard set of things, theory mainly, that you should know. So it didn't really matter. But today, the gap between people graduating and getting a job that's, you know, assumes that they've learned something in their degree is pretty big. And so the teachers and the educators also have to close that gap within their own work.
Yeah. For me,
what have you been up to?
You know what? I'm finishing this book. I am right at the end.
Finishing? That's great.
I think the next time we talk, the next time people hear us, I will be done with my first draft.
First draft. That's what I was going to say. Like, you're not finishing the book. You're just finished with the first draft.
Yeah, but then it goes out to reviewers, and then I have to just sit on my hands for a while while they do the work. So I get like a little vacation.
Right.
And man, it is definitely, writing books is long.
Do you have writer's block and things like that, or is it pretty straightforward?
I don't have writer's block, but there are topics to hit which are so important to get right that it's very daunting, and I have to force myself not to put them off.
Right? Because
like, you know, like you can write a part of the book on like a little bit of pre-processing, and it's like super easy. Like, here's how you standardize something, and it's like, oh, cool. That, you know, like I'll just zip through that. That's awesome. And then the next part will be like convolutional neural network.
Right.
Like, okay. I have to do this correctly. I need to do research beforehand, and then that's sort of like it's very daunting task to get into it. So I'm almost done, but I am sort of like white knuckling it while I type through.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I can imagine you like just fueling it with coffee and working all night, but you're probably not doing that. You're probably being sane, right?
I'm trying to only do, I mean, I'm working a lot each day, but I'm trying to only do like sort of 6 hours of it a day because I tried to push through really hard at one point, and then I started getting lazy in how I describe stuff because you can, you know, like you can address a topic well, and you can address a topic like writing wise really quickly. And I started to do that, and I was like, no, we have to stop. I need to like be ready to handle that.
I think there's something interesting here because I remember being in the startup world of pushing and going crazy. And definitely there's a point where, you know, the quality starts taking a hit.
Legit.
Mm-hmm. So story time. I'm going to assume that most of our listeners really love science and they have a deep love for the scientific method and for the pursuit of understanding more about the world we live in through experimentation and research and, you know, the formal study of things through science. And I know I run in my own life pretty informal non-scientific experiments that test my hypotheses like intuitively on all sorts of things in my life. Like I'm constantly doing that. And I'm sure a lot of us do that too, just even in social settings or things like identifying how a new swimming technique is actually impacting my lap times and energy levels. Like I just discovered that if I swim slower, then I actually get there faster and with less energy wasted. Like,
wow,
crazy things like that. Like, wow, I have to in my head, if I'm like swim like a grandma and go really well, not that grandmas have to be slow, sorry. I don't know why I said that. I meant a slow person. Swim like a really slow person. And it works. It like makes me swim. It just makes me swim in a more relaxed way. And, you know, it actually makes me. And so things like that, I'm like always researching and trying things out and testing and kind of keeping certain things see certain factors consistent while like changing specific factors to see if there's anything predictive, and working on my own health. And there's a lot of data collection involved and trend watching, lots of hypotheses testing and experimenting. And this is basically my personal life from morning to night. I mean, this is what I actually do on all sorts of weird things. Yeah, like from food to everything. But I actually don't end up doing much formal experimentation in a work setting myself. Mm-hmm. I work more on the problem solving, innovation, real world side of data science. Like, how do non-data science people end up getting the most advantage out of the insights and out of the technology being built by data science? So I rely on data scientists and their rigor of experimentation quite a lot in my work, because that's kind of the place where I sit as I bridge the world between them and the end benefactors. And so my story this week is, just want to kind of give it a heads up, is from my perspective of real world applications of data science and my experience in working on challenges around like mainly commercializing or bringing to market the new insights or technologies that come from science. Okay. But there's a bit of a technical background. So before I dive into the technical and fascinating details, I just want to pose that the big question this story forces us to ask ourselves is, how do we know to trust the results of scientific experiments?
Oh, wow. We are really diving in here.
Right. It's like a pretty shocking question to ask right now, like so late in the science game, right? I mean, we wouldn't have all the innovation and understanding as humans without having some mechanisms already in place for trusting, quote, evidence that comes from science. But 72 prominent statisticians, psychologists, economists, sociologists, political scientists, biomedical researchers, and lots of other smarties from around the world want us to re-examine this a core principle of data science and call us to question how we know to trust the results of experiments by re-examining the p-value.
Oh, wow. We are really digging in here.
Yeah, it gets deep. I'm going to need your help. So the story needs like a bunch of technical setting up, which I am not going to be the good person for doing that. So I'm going to make Chris, you know, the de facto flashcard king of the internet, do this for me. So Chris, can you give me a quick, and everybody, just can you give a quick explanation of what the heck p-value actually is?
This is putting me on the spot. You know, there's actually a video where someone stood outside a psych conference, I think, and then asked people when they're walking out, like clearly researchers, like what a p-value was, and a lot of them could answer it. But I can't answer it. So here we go. Let me think about this for like 1 second.
Okay. I mean, you're such an expert. You're writing a book. You should know.
It is okay. Fine. So imagine we find a coin. And we suspect that this coin is like a trick coin, like a coin from a magic shop. Hmm. And say that we think that this coin is rigged to flip a lot of heads, so way more heads than tails. That is our hypothesis. It's also called an alternative hypothesis, but don't worry about that part. So to examine this, what is typically done in research, like this is a very, very standard way, is we first set up the counterexample that we call the null hypothesis. So say that we set up this null hypothesis to say that this regular coin that, sorry, let me think about this for 1 second. Okay. We set up a null hypothesis, and the null hypothesis says that this is a regular coin, right? So we are assuming this is a regular coin. And if it has a regular coin, it has a 50-50 chance of being heads and tails, right? That is our just null hypothesis that this is true. And if we flip it 1,000 times, it'll be roughly heads 500 times and tails 500 times, sort of somewhere along.
Assuming this null hypothesis.
Assuming this null hypothesis, and this is when we work on these topics, we always come from it from the null hypothesis. So, we think something's true. We take the counterexample, which is the null hypothesis. We set that up, and then we work from there. So. Now we have our null hypothesis. This is a real regular coin that you could spend money on, has a 50-50 chance of heads and tails. And then we gather our data. So we start flipping the coin, say, you know, 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. And when we flip our coin 1,000 times, let's say it comes up 900 times its heads, right? Mm-hmm. So it's supposed to be 50-50, which 500 heads, 500 tails. And instead we have 900 heads and 100 tails. Mm-hmm. What we do is we compare our data to what we would expect in this world of the null hypothesis, right? 50-50. Mm-hmm. And we imagine that we are in this world of the Snell hypothesis, correct? And if this is a fair coin, we ask ourselves, well, what is the probability of getting 900 heads or more if this is a fair coin? Mm-hmm. And of course, that would be really fucking small. Like, that's going to be right. a small probability that you have a just a regular fair coin and you're getting
right.
tons of heads. That probability is called a p-value.
Mm-hmm.
And if that p-value, right, the probability of the null hypothesis is true, you know, like if the null hypothesis is true of getting that extreme of result or greater is lower than some threshold, so like say 5%, which is why we say things like 0.05, mm-hmm. we say that the hypothesis, our regular alternative hypothesis, is statistically significant.
Got it. I think I get it. So a p-value of 0.05 is that threshold that scientists are working to beat or match, right?
It's the threshold that says if we get a result that is so unlikely, as in it has a low p-value, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, very unlikely uh-huh. for that to happen. It can't be from randomness. It has
Got
to
it.
Be from the effect. So like, for example, if you had an experiment, say people taking a pill that you thought maybe made them live longer, mm-hmm. like the null hypothesis is that they don't live longer, so the number of years they gain is zero. But if everyone's gaining 50 years and everyone's living to like 150, like that would be really, really, really a small probability of that being true
right.
if the pill had no effect. That's sort of what we're getting.
Right. So really, though, directly, it's just proving the null hypothesis false, or you're trying to prove it false, kind of.
You're sort of testing, yeah. It's testing. So like we'll say like the thing that people always say is they reject the null hypothesis.
Right.
That's
Got
the
it.
Term.
Got it. And that's kind of the goal in a way.
I think it's, I would say that the goal is probably somewhere along. I think it's from a scientific philosophy.
Right.
There's no goal.
There's
You're just
no goal,
looking
right.
at the universe from like a practical point of view. If people Correct. Like, you know, want to get papers, there's probably a goal in there.
Right. Okay. So that's interesting. So this isn't necessarily prove that the experimental hypothesis is like totally true. That like, it just means that the null hypothesis is rejected. For sure.
Right. And there's all these phrases that people will use around it. You'll see it in papers all the time where like no one will say, oh, I reject the null hypothesis. Therefore, my alternative hypothesis is true. They'll be saying it lends evidence. You know,
right.
Like, just...
So I think that's what this article is zeroing on, is that in the process of saying the null hypothesis was rejected, I think some people tend to think that directly means that the original experimental hypothesis was proven to be true.
Right.
And I think that's a subtle point, but I think that's kind of how, you know, like glamour magazines and all these like silly magazines will take some of these results and then take it to mean, you know, develop relationships that don't exist or et cetera. And there's a lovely quote that according to Rebecca Golden, who's the director for stats.org and a math professor at George Mason University, sounds like she would know. She says, generally, p-values should not be used to make conclusions, but rather to identify possibilities like a sniff test.
Mm-hmm.
And according to this article, many papers that have used the 0.05 significance threshold, this is crazy, have not replicated with more methodologically rigorous designs. That's kind of insane. I don't know that that's like a direct thing. It's not like if you have, obviously you can't draw a correlation there. But I think it's interesting that a lot of the papers make it harder to get them replicated. Or maybe people aren't just repeating them. I mean, there's so many things here. Is it that people aren't repeating them, or are they repeating them and then not able to get the same results?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I should just get on my soapbox. I had a soapbox from a few episodes ago. I'm taking it back out.
There it is.
You know, as someone who you know, got a PhD and went in academia and did research for like a while, I guess I just only did academia while I was getting my PhD, but whatever. I did research. So like, this is where it is really hard for people outside academia to understand these things, like mm-hmm. not the theoretical side, but just the practicalities of this. Because, for example, most papers are not even read. Like, no one even reads the papers that you write. You know, like you're in a field, you're in like a very right. small part of the field. Like, of course, a drug that cured cancer is going to get lots of people who might want to replicate it. But a small thing about how, you know, a teeny mm-hmm. indigenous plant in Bolivia grows slightly more towards the sun is like not a paper that people are going to bother to replicate. And so, you know, there's this there's this idea in science where what we want to do is someone writes a paper and then someone else replicates the paper and then five other people replicate the paper. Mm-hmm. And then like through all these replications, and if they all point in one direction, like that's a really good sign that something is true. And that does happen in certain areas like drug tests or that kind of thing, but it doesn't happen in a lot of areas.
Hmm.
And this is why this, you know, having a 0.05 significance threshold is kind of a really firm sticking point, or not a firm sticking point, a really point of contention.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's this line that basically if you want to publish a paper, you have to get past this 0.05 threshold. So let me take a little bit of a step back. People think of academia as this big ivory tower where like people totally secure in their lives and, you know, like wellness, and are sitting there thinking deep thoughts and like a big library like surrounded by books or something. And that is not true. Like academia is super, super competitive. Like research is insanely competitive. People are fighting for, you know, tenure, they're fighting for jobs, they're fighting for grant money, they're fighting for promotion, they're fighting for raises, they're fighting for prestige. Like it is a incredibly, incredibly competitive world. And sort of two things become true in this. Like one, people advance in the field by finding big, awesome results of like totally original, novel theories. They don't get it by replicating other people's stuff, right? Mm, like no one wins the Nobel Prize for replicating someone else's Nobel Prize work, right? You get it because you have your own Nobel Prize theory that no one's ever thought about before. Like that's sort of where the incentives lie. Second, you know, there's the saying in academia, you know, publish or perish, which is literally like publish papers or get fired or lose that grant or get passed over for promotion. Like there's a really strong part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And like given those pressures, and given that people aren't sort of loafing around in their academic jobs, getting results is incredibly important to people's personal lives.
Mm.
Like whether they get the raise so they can, you know, pay for their kids' school or their grandparents' medicine, like it is a huge incentive for you to be able to publish papers. And in order to publish papers, you have to have a statistically significant result, typically a like better than that 0.05 threshold. So there's this massive incentive to just get your research over that line.
Mm-hmm.
And two things happen from that. One, people, you know, sort of are biased towards getting their results, right? So that's what we were talking about before. Like a scientist should come neutral into the topic. But say, for example, you know, like you've been working on a project and collecting data for it for 2 years, you are actually hoping you get a result, right? Like, you know, like just like you study something for 2 years, you collect the data and then you're like, nope, it's just random. Well, oh, well, you know, like,
right.
No, you're like biased towards wanting to do that. And that can affect you in sort of, you know, like unconscious ways of you tweaking things. Second, there's the more explicit one, which like there's this thing called p-hacking or p-phishing, which is where sort of, you know, you're sitting there and you need to get above the point, or you need to get better than the 0.05 threshold. And so you will take a model and run it. Maybe you get like, you know, you're like 0.1 or something. So not underneath the threshold. And you're like, okay, so maybe I'll like add a variable, try it again, delete that variable, log a variable, try it again. You know, like just you're just like constantly running little variations of your model. And like eventually, because you'll figure out some combination, you'll like sneak underneath the line and then you're
got
like
it.
Done. I'm at 0.5. But of course, that's not science at that point. You're literally just like playing a game of trying to get under that number.
Right.
But like, I feel like I'm trying to iterate that like these aren't sort of detached, aloof individuals.
Mm-hmm.
These are highly
mm-hmm.
competitive individuals in a highly competitive field trying to, you know, like get raises like everyone else.
Well, that was super enlightening. I had no idea. I think it just shows that there's a huge gap between the reality of developing and finding new things and creating original work, and then what both the public and also maybe like the business world kind of sees science, how they see science as, you know, a particular, you know, process that we learned in seventh grade. You know what I mean? Like the scientific method, like you have to replicate it, and then this is how you know that something is actually valid. And I think that that gap hasn't really been bridged. So I hope there's a way to actually address the reality of it and then maybe change the way that we look at the results of this. I mean, I know that in 2015, there was a paper that attempted to replicate 100 findings published in a major psychological journal, and only 39% passed when they tried to replicate it. And so at the end of the day, as people who want to build on top of research, we need to know when something is real and true and actually replicatable. And there's, you know, it can be reproduced, and not only because for the sake of reproducibility, but really so that I can then build something on top of that and know that it's going to work the way that I expect it to work.
Yeah, that's a huge point, that like when you, like in any kind of research endeavor, I know, especially in the social sciences, I'm assuming in all fields, but when I was doing all of my research, there's all these other papers out there, and basically if they're published, you look at them, and if they seem reasonable, like you assume that is true, and then you build your theory off of it, or like mm-hmm. you partially assume it's true, but like you are building, papers are being built on papers, being built on papers over and over and over again. And like, what if a good portion of them aren't actually true?
Yeah. And you know what? Another really interesting little data point is that studies that actually have super significant results where the p-value is less than 0.01% are more likely to reproduce than those that are at the 0.05 level.
Oh yeah, I bet.
So, right, of course, because it's more rare for it to be wrong, I guess, is the way to think about it. And so these 72 experts that I referred to earlier, this is their big proposal. They propose a change to p-value being under 0.005. And they say that this simple step would immediately improve the reproducibility of scientific research in many fields. So lowering the threshold to that, you know, to 0.005, which would mean that a lot of them that are out there that meet the 0.05 wouldn't be considered statistically significant. But what I like is that the ones that do meet the 0.05 level today will be called, the word they're using is called suggestive results. And then the ones that actually meet the 0.005 will be called statistically significant, which I kind of like. They're not throwing it all away. They're just saying, let's just call them suggestive and not statistically significant.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is actually a really interesting idea. So what we're saying is that, you know, you set up your null world that you think is true. You know, you think this is truth, and you get a result and you say, okay, that's 5%. That would be 5% likely to be true if, you know, like if this null world is correct. What they're saying is 0.5% likely, so like way more rare an event, which, you know, the thing that I really like about this, I guess there's a few points. One, with things like p-hacking, p-phishing, that kind of stuff, like you can change the p-value around, but like it would be a lot harder to go from like to get to 0.005, right? Like a very, very, very low p-value. Because like if the effect isn't there, the effect isn't there. And maybe you can like, you know, jiggle it around a little bit to move it up and down, you know, like, I don't know, just a few percentage points, but not 0.5%, right? Like you would have to do something insane and hopefully really obvious to other researchers.
Right.
And like, I know there's been a move recently to sort of hate on p-values, and like, don't get me wrong, like I have my pitchfork ready. I was not a fan of p-values when I was doing a lot of stuff. But like, there is people talking about getting rid of p-values altogether. Huh. Like you would just state the p-value threshold they want to get rid of. So you just like state the p-value in the paper. You just be like, hey, if this drug has no effect, we should see a 10% chance of people, you know, like, or if this null world is correct, there should be a 10% chance of seeing the data that we see, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's their sort of thing. And I like this on one level, because one of the biggest problems with p-values is the fact it's like an arbitrary threshold. Like I basically guarantee you that the reason you see a lot of papers just over the 0.05 threshold is because it's the difference between that getting published and not. And like, imagine you've like a 4.5% p-value, and you need to get to 5%, or sorry, you have like a 5.1 and you need to get a 4.9, right? Like you just like tweak it over, you know, like just drop a case, like whatever, you know, like of course, like there's a huge incentive, these are real people, for people to do this. But like, you know, the issue with that kind of stuff is that like, if you don't have a p-value, if you don't have a threshold, there's this worry I guess I have around the idea of like novel papers doing better than really well-made papers. So, for example, if you're a magazine or, say, a journal, and you want to publish a paper, and there's one paper that has a really crazy theory, like fucking dinosaur bones cured with 80s rock music can cure cancer or something like that, right? Like, a crazy cool theory, you totally want to publish it, but it has, like, a really crappy p-value. And then there's another study that says, like, running is good for you, but it's super statistically significant. You know, like, and of course, like, there's a big chance that the dino rock cancer theory paper is going to get published and the other one doesn't. So, like, I think, I see the value in the idea of having a really, really, really strict p-value, mm-hmm. and just making it so people have... You know, there's less papers because the bar is higher. I'm okay with that.
Well, I think people would just have to read a ton more if there was no threshold altogether.
Yeah, well, right? And you would, I think the thing is that, like, I remember when I was reading a lot of journal articles, the fact that they were sort of, they had a sort of p-value threshold meant that if I got a journal, I got, like, a paper journal a lot of times. So, like, if I got this paper journal and I held it up, everything in there has been sort of rigorously vetted that I don't actually have to sit down and, like, tear every single paper apart right. for 4 days before I decide to cite it. I could sort of read it right. and be like, that sounds reasonable. Look at this solid p-value. Cool, cool, cool. Imagine, but, like, for each of those papers in there, there's probably 100 papers that didn't get, like, any kind of good stuff. And so right. it would be, like, it's kind of hard to sort of sift
well,
through.
Well, I guess on the other hand, they would argue that those papers that you think are rigorously tested aren't, in fact, at right. the p-value of 0.05. So can you even trust that today?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I definitely got disillusioned towards the end of political science around right. like papers with, like, a super, I don't know, just like a lot of suspicious p-values. And then I began to really trust researchers, like individual researchers that I either knew or knew about or had read a lot of their work right. where it was good work. And I was just like, okay, cool. I can trust the stuff coming out of this person or right. this lab or something like that, rather than, like, if it is in this journal, it's good. Because right. that's, you know, obviously not the case. But I'll admit, like, if they lowered the p-value to a really low degree, I feel like that's a safer bet, right? I mean, it's obvious. Literally, it's a safer bet. But, like...
Right. Right. That is the definition. Right.
So, you know, like, there'll be less papers that are statistically significant, but you can be really confident about those papers. And I'm okay with that. Like, I think that's fine. I think I would like to see two things. One, I guess a really low p-value threshold for these kind of things. And I would like journals that allow you to publish not statistically significant results. So you can just dump all your trash out and sort of get career credit for it. Right. Because, like, I mean, that was one of the things where, like, because if I run an experiment and it's not statistically significant, I don't tell anybody because I don't publish it. I just right. sort of, like just leave the folder on my computer.
Wouldn't
and move on to the next
helpful?
Thing.
Also, it for people to know that that wasn't statistically significant, I feel like that could be useful information.
That is very useful information, absolutely. And, like, this way doesn't work, and this right. effect didn't really work. And no, and it all comes back to, like, careers, right? You don't get, you can't right. publish a null result, like, no statistical significance. So people don't publish that. So they don't spend time on that. If something doesn't seem to be working out, they just drop it and move on to the next thing. Because you're trying to get statistically significant results so you can advance your career. And, like, that's not what science should be, but this is a human endeavor,
right.
not, like, a
right.
theoretical endeavor. And humans are humans. You know, like, I love science, but don't get me wrong. There's a, like, a big incentive to do, you know, like, get certain things. And one of those is publishing.
Yeah, there's a real cultural element to this discussion, it sounds like. You know, at the same time, like... on the business side of things and on the application side of things, I'm kind of in two minds on it, because if the higher threshold, lower threshold, I don't know, the higher, lower number, higher threshold, right. it tends to filter out more research to a point where people later in the chain of bringing that stuff into the world don't see it at all, I'm kind of worried that there might be a loss of innovative ideas that might spark something, you know, that just knowing that it isn't statistically significant is really helpful. And I'd rather know that this is suggestive, quote, suggestive and not statistically significant, but still see it.
yeah.
rather than not seeing it at all. So it would be what I would like is if there was some kind of cultural shift towards still allowing the p value of 0.05 being valid in an academic setting.
No, I
can see it. Not that somehow it's like, oh, if it's not below 0.005, then it should be chucked.
Yeah. So one of the things that happens in academia is that people, new graduate students, attempt to get tenure, right? So mm-hmm. like that's the big goal. Once you get to the PhD program, you basically work your butt off super fast to get tenure. And there's always like, at least in political science, there was like essentially a point system around whether or not you got tenure. It didn't work out like exactly like this, but like if you had, say, you know, if you had 10 articles, that would be 10 points, and maybe you only needed 6 to get tenure. And if you had a book, it was worth 3 points. And, you know, like there was this sort of like unofficial point system kind of thing. And I could totally imagine a situation where if you got something at the 0.005 and got published, like the really, really high threshold, the very, very, very difficult to reach threshold, you right. got like a point, where if you got a paper that was merely suggestive, right. you got half a point or something. Right. So you still got stuff that you can go and work on it. And there is ways to do that. Like if you do research and you apply for a conference, like a certain tier of papers get accepted for the paper to be presented, mm-hmm. and then sort of lesser papers or lesser work gets put into posters, so people will have posters out. Uh-huh. So it's like a lesser form of a paper, because you're experimenting with an idea, or maybe you're a young researcher, right. or maybe like you kind of want to show off your thing that you're doing, so hopefully you can find other people who are interested in working on it. Like there's a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I just think as long as you get some credit for it, right? You get certain yeah. amount of credit for suggestive results and more for statistically right. significant results. I mean I am totally, totally in favor of that.
Would you have been in favor of it as a PhD student?
Would I have been a PhD student? I mean, yeah, I think I would, because one of the issues that I had towards the end of right when I was sort of at the disillusioned part of my writing my dissertation, was like I had a really hard time believing if a study was true or not based on the statistically significant results, because there's, you know, like data is really messy, social things are really, really complex, and I think at the end of it I sort of considered everything published as being suggestive. So I really wouldn't have minded if there was like a yeah. really, you know, if there was a higher bar where I could sort of see something and be like, oh, okay, cool. Like that's a legit thing.
Yeah. You know what's actually that I'm thinking? I bet you a tiny little change, like adding another decimal point, would probably affect the economics of academic pursuit hugely. Like if it's going to take you know, that much more effort and energy and rigor to get it to a point that is statistically significant, you might actually end up spending more money and being on it more times and running it more times, et cetera, which I don't know. I think that could create a whole huge, I don't know if that'll work, you know, in the economics of things.
Yeah. I mean, I think everything would change things around, but I think what would really throw everything in a loop, if you got rid of threshold right. at all, because then it would just be sort of like this.
Yeah. Every totally, man for themselves.
Every man for himself, just like craziness. Right. But right. I could totally see journals saying like, hey, we used to have this threshold, because they do have like essentially a threshold. Like they right. might state it explicitly, they might not state it explicitly, but it's the sort of, it's the, you know, it's the fields thing. Like political science right. is 0.05. That was sort of like, it's
right. threshold. Yeah, and that so was one of the most, oh, go ahead.
If journals sort of said, we are a very prestigious journal, we are only doing 0.005.
Right.
Right. We are making it harder to right. get your paper into this thing. I'm okay with that, man.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I was just reading that this, apparently there are other scientific disciplines that have a different p-value as their threshold. And so in genetics research, for that research to be statistically significant, they use p-values of less than 0.0000005.
Yeah.
and that makes sense, because it's like genetics. It's, you know, it's people and food and animals and things and plants and things that are related to life. So you kind of want to be sure that this, you know, the results of this study are something that you can actually rely on. And then the other one in astrophysics, apparently it's like astronomical levels of significance is required, which makes sense. Like putting people in outer space, like we want to be sure that this is going to work.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that one of the reasons I don't like the p-value thresholds is that it sort of allows a researcher to export responsibility for their research question to this mm-hmm. value, right? So, like, for example, if you say we have a drug that has no ill effects, there's no side effects to the drug, and the drug costs $1. And say we do a study and the p-value is like 0.1. So there's a 10% chance of seeing this result even if it has no effect. Like, that's okay. Like, it's only a buck. There's a buck. There's no side effects. Like, go ahead, man.
Try
like,
it.
Try it. Right? Because, like, the cost is very low if you're wrong. Now, that's different if it's like there's a 10% chance, like if I'm wrong, people are going to die.
Right.
Like, then you want to change right. the level to something that's appropriate.
Right. But that's interesting. Like, maybe gauge the threshold based off the null hypothesis and the impact of that on, like, people in life.
Right. I mean, and that's what, like, whenever I use p-value in my work now, which is, like, in business and organizations where I'm not trying to reach some thresholds, the p-value is determined by how much I care about false positives and false mm-hmm. negatives. Not, there is no threshold. Like, there's nothing is statistically right. significant because I don't care about that. And the client doesn't care about that. And the other people totally. On the team doesn't care about that. Like, it is about making sure that we, you know, choose something that is totally reasonable for what we're going for. And we look at that 10% number or whatever the number is, 10%, 5%, 0.5%, whatever we right. want to use. But we're choosing that number explicitly. But right. the reason that we can do that is because we're doing it on our own team and we don't have to really worry about that right. kind of stuff. There's no like publishing yeah. or perish thing. We're just trying to, you know, be okay with it.
I think that is awesome. That to me seems like it solves, at least for my world, it solves it because it does put the responsibility back on us and on our team to pick something that sounds reasonable and is appropriate for the context of it instead of just like passing the buck.
Right. Just get to the threshold and you're good. And like, right. I'll say that like, you know, like there's a problem with the get to the threshold and you're good syndrome, but if that threshold was really, really high, I'm totally okay with it.
Yeah,
you know, like or sort totally. Of okay with it. Like I get the idea that like, if you're going to do science at scale, there's going to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of papers. And like, if you got rid of any kind of threshold, like, you know, like, as you said, every man for himself just going crazy and like, right. my paper has dinosaur bones, like, screw you, we should get it published. And so, right. like, a threshold, you know, is, I think that's okay, but I really do like the high threshold. That's cool. That's super cool. All right. That is the episode for this week. If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe anywhere you listen to your podcast. We will be back next week. In the meantime, you can follow us at @PartiallyD on Twitter. You can follow Vid at @Vid_Spandana. You can follow me at @ChrisAlbin. And you can follow Jonathan at @JonathanMorgan. Have a great week, all.
See ya.